We're happy to welcome to the program a Grammy Award winner, Emmy Award winner, Dove Award winner, as an acclaimed recording engineer, producer, and musician who's got a brand new memoir out entitled Chairman at the Board, Recording the Soundtrack of a Generation. If Boz Scaggs were here, he might introduce him as Schnalian. If Huey Lewis were here, he might welcome in Schnoo. We'll just say, Bill Schnee, thanks so much for being with us today.
That's funny. Thank you for having me.
Well, I loved your book. What a wonderful ride it has been for you. You have literally worked with everybody in the music business. And, well, as a fellow only child, music is much better than an imaginary friend, right?
It sure was for me. Yep.
Now, growing up, I thought this was very interesting. You were a fan of Herb Alpert, one of my personal favorites, and also Henry Mancini. What was it that drew you to their work?
You know, I think I'm very lucky that I love all kinds of music, and it's kind of changed over the years. As I was growing up, but the Mancini records, I was attracted to the sound as well as to the music itself. But, you know, I watched Peter Gunn, and so when that came out, I went and bought that album and then saw the movie Breakfast at Tiffany's, that kind of thing, and buying soundtracks, and I just loved the way they sounded and became a fan of Hank's work.
Well, and as you heard, we have appropriated his Peter Gunn theme as the theme of our show as well. It worked better for Craig Stevens than it does for me.
Okay.
Well, you had the music dream like so many people, and like so many, you joined a band. Tell us a little bit about your experience with the L.A. Teens.
Yeah, the L.A. Teens. Yeah, we started a band my senior year of high school. My parents moved to Los Angeles, and I've met some new friends, and they were starting a band, so I got in with them. And we started writing songs and ultimately went and did a demo, a couple of demos in a local recording studio, and one of the kid's mother knew someone who knew someone that was in the music business, and that someone was a guy named Gary Usher. Gary was lived rather close to the Wilson Beach Boy Wilson family. In fact, it was close with them, and he wanted to be a Beach Boy, but that didn't happen. However, he did write 409 and In My Room with Brian,
right.
And he signed us. He had a new production deal with Decca Records, and he signed us, and we went into Capitol Studios, and in those days you signed up for four sides, you recorded four songs. They put out a single or two. If you managed to get a hit, then you ran in and cut six more sides. Suffice it to say that we didn't do an album.
But you had some action in L.A. You posted a picture in the book of one of the charts when you were, well, just ahead of a little band from England.
Yeah, I love that chart where we're ahead of the Beatles. Of course, they were probably on their way up, and we were peaking. I don't know. Yeah, we made some noise, that's for sure, but not enough to stir the pot, so to speak.
Now, you would find your real calling a different role in the studio, and one of the people who had such an influence on your life was the great Richie Podolor. How did you two get together?
Well, when we did our first sessions with Gary Usher at Capitol, he brought in Richie as a guitarist. Richie is a phenomenal musician, and he brought him in to augment the band with some guitar ideas. And when we got dropped, Richie had his studio, and said, "You know, I'd really, you know, it's kind of a drag. We got dropped." And he said, "You guys were great. I can get you a deal. Go see this guy, Mike Curb. He's going to go places." And sure enough, Mike Curb has gone places. But so we signed our second deal and went into a cut with Richie, and went cut the first track and came in and he's playing it back, and I looked up at those speakers as the track was playing back, and I was just amazed, because here we had recorded at two of the best studios in Hollywood, and Richie's studio was a lot funkier, but the emotion that I was hearing in our band from this track that he cut was like something I'd never heard. And it was really an aha moment, and I literally stopped when it was over. I pointed at all the equipment and said, "Can you teach me how to do this?" And he said, "No, I'm teaching Cooper. Get out there and do another track." And but that was the moment. That Well, that was the aha moment that I knew I wanted to do that.
And then he gave you really your first opportunity working with a band that I think is one of the most underrated bands in rock music history, Three Dog Night.
Yeah. Yeah, he was, that's the funny thing. So I went off and found a real cheap studio that would, where I could get my feet wet, so to speak, and built it up. And all my aptitude was in math and science. And so where the left brain met the musical right, engineering came very quickly to me. So in just about 2.5 years after that first session with Richie, where I didn't know an equalizer from a limiter, I managed, after 2 months of begging, to let him try me out on a session with a demo. And so he had me do a demo with a publishing demo. And he said I did great. And so then I did another demo the next day. And how did that client say? They said, you did great. He said, okay, why don't you come in tomorrow night and do Three Dog Night? And of course, I froze in my tracks. And I couldn't believe my ears, because Richie was only engineering them then. He would go on after that album. That was their second album, Suitable for Framing. After that, he went on to produce the long string of hits they had. But at that point, he was just engineering them. The producer was Gabriel Meckler, who also produced Steppenwolf that Richie had recorded and also went on to produce. And so it doesn't make an ounce of sense why he would turn over his biggest client with a big group that had already had a hit and was working their way to be, you know, one of the biggest groups in the country, turn it over to this young snot-nosed kid. But I'm sure glad he did.
We're talking with Bill Schnee on Downtown, and that led to another opportunity from one of the biggest names in the business when you got a call from Clive Davis.
Right, yeah. That was the big break. My dad was a Jewish doctor, so many of you might know what that means. I was going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or else. And so I knew I couldn't be a doctor. So I did start law school when I went to work for Richie. But I got through the first semester and got the grades as I started the second semester. And I'd been faking it. I just didn't have the time to do the reading with the sessions I was doing and the classwork. So I decided to quit for a year and a half. I had quit college for 2.5 years chasing the LA teams. And so now I decided I'll quit for a year and a half. And if music can make it, great. If it doesn't, I'll get the stupid degree. And I was just about ready. A year went by, and I was just about ready to enroll when a friend of mine got a deal with Clive and told him about me. And Clive called me and, you know, scared the bejeebies out of me and said, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I think I'm going back to law school. And he said, no, I went to law school. If you have music in your blood, you know that's what you're going to want to do. And I said, well, I would love to, but, and he basically took the but away. So, yeah, he gave me the shot that kept me from being a lawyer. And my mother was convinced that the legal system is much better for it. But
now, you've worked with so many interesting people through the years. And one of the people who keeps reappearing in your book is Richard Perry, a very talented guy. I thought it was interesting that you point out that sometimes he worked best with those who weren't as willing to share their opinions. And you mentioned the Pointer Sisters, who were just very happy to take his direction and go, but not everybody was that way.
Right. You know, I've always said that, you know, there's all different kinds of producers. There's the one on one end, like the guy that can, P. Diddy, for instance, can write the song, arrange the song, record the song, put the singer on it. If he doesn't like the way the singer sings it, he says, we'll find something else for you. And he sings it. He can do anything and everything. So there's that one. And then on the complete other end, there's the kind I kind of call chemists, where they figure out what, you know, what good engineer is, what, you know, and they usually have a good song sense, maybe arrangers, musicians, and they put all the pieces together and kind of shake it up. Richard is, you know, definitely right. Dead, kind of like me, dead set in the middle. And there's no special producer for an artist. I mean, the only thing that matters is that there's a good marriage between the two. And what I'm trying to say is that one kind of producer doesn't work for everybody. And I just found that Richard didn't work well with either super creative people or groups for whatever reason. But you know, he, and that's terrible to say when I think about it, because, you know, Harry Nilsson, talk about super creative. Mm. He did fine with him, at least on the first album, Nilsson Schmilsson. And of course, we did three big albums for Carly Simon.
You also worked through Richard with Barbara Streisand, and you found her very easy to work with. She certainly knows what she wants, but I think she seems like she appreciated your professionalism.
Yeah, I really feel like I've had favor with a lot of artists that other people find trouble with, she being maybe the biggest one. I've never met anyone else that can say what I can, which is I've never had the first problem with her, and I've worked with her, you know, over the years. But, you know, she's very demanding. She's very intelligent. She knows what she wants, and she acts fast and thinks fast, and I do too. But what I usually find that helps is to be able to tell an artist, you know, no, or you shouldn't, not as much no as you really shouldn't do that. And, you know, she would look at me and say, well, why not? I said, well, because this actually is a tree. We climb up this tree and get off on this branch over here. It's very likely to break and we're going to come tumbling down. In other words, if you tell them that you have their best interest in mind and, you know, can we find a better way to do this, that kind of thing, it works out really well. But yeah, she's just been great with me.
You mentioned Carly Simon, and your first opportunity was working with her on the No Secrets album. That earned you a Grammy nomination for Best Engineered Album. And I liked your description of Carly as being somewhere between the approach of a Carole King and a Joni Mitchell, but with a much better voice than either one.
Yeah. Yeah, I just listened to that No Secrets record the other day, and I just find that, you know, that was the most artistic person I had worked with. That was pretty early in my career, about 3 years in from being professional, 3.5 years or something. And the songwriting, her songwriting was just, I thought, exquisite in that record. Everything from the obvious pompous delivery of You're So Vain to some of the more artistic things that are on there. Just really beautiful.
And you share the great story. I'm a huge Harry Nilsson fan, but you share the wonderful story of how Nilsson was there with the intent of singing backup on You're So Vain until somebody else wandered into the studio and Harry himself decided, well, this guy might do a better job.
Yeah, and it's kind of funny because a lot of people don't even realize it until I tell them. And then that when next time you listen to it, you realize that that's Mick Jagger singing with her. And because his voice has so much character, you might not have thought that it would work compared to Harry, who can, you know, mold his voice, could just melt in with anybody. But it gave it a great character. It was a real shock for me to pull up the fader. It wasn't marked Mick on the 24 track. I only mixed that album. I recorded a lot of the next two, but I only mixed that when it was done in England. And when I pulled up the background voice and heard it, I went, wait a minute, I'm mixing a Rolling Stone. What is this?
Well, you got to work with all the royalty, and I love the stories about working with Ringo on his self-titled third album, the last time that all three Beatles worked together, and really all the Beatles were involved because you crossed the pond to work with Paul and Linda.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's very unfortunate that Paul had a little problem with drugs here in the United States, and he wasn't allowed to come in for a while because I'm pretty sure that what went on for that record was that the three Beatles all knew that their solo careers were going to do fine, but maybe we should give Ringo a leg up, and that's what it felt like. And I think enough of the bad blood had dried up in those almost 3 years from the breakup to where we were cutting Ringo that if Paul could have come in the country, I'm pretty sure could have been. A full Beatle reunion. But when John Lennon came in, the song he had for Ringo, the word got out, and from that day on, John was only there the one night on that album for the one song he wrote, but the word got out, and there were TV trucks in the parking lot of Sunset Sound every night thereafter, waiting, hoping for a glimpse of the reunion.
I love the story too, Paul's contribution that I always thought was him playing the kazoo, but that was really Paul's vocal work and some of your engineering magic.
Yeah. Yes. We stumbled around for a little bit trying to find something to give it a sound, but finally got what we got, and it came off kind of fun, I think.
Some of the most interesting work, because I knew so little about how it worked, was reading about your work doing direct-to-disc recording. Can you explain what that high wire act was all about?
Yeah. Of course, you know, in the beginning of discs in the 78 era, everything was recorded direct-to-disc. We didn't have tape yet, but of course, 78s don't have a very long playing time. So what direct-to-disc in the LP world means is you go in and record one whole side of an album right to the disc. I mean, it's a mechanical disc that cuts, you know, a lacquer master that ultimately gets turned into a press that allows the pressing of records. So you can't stop it and start it. So once it starts, you're on. So basically, we all go in, and from song one to song two to song three to song four, we just play it and mix it as it goes. And, you know, we always had, you know, I always put together an outstanding band, just ridiculous musicianship to be able to do that. And they got very excited about it. It was a lot of fun, that first Thelma Houston one that I produced, which is really the one that launched it in the modern, launched direct-to-disc in the modern era. And, but, you know, you were on your toes, you know, mixing, for instance, is because if you're mixing from a tape or from a disc, a hard disc, you know, the guitar comes out the same, comes to you every single time, the same dynamics, same tone, everything, vocal, everything's identical, every single pass. When you're doing it like this, of course, everything, you know, they're human beings, and it's not going to be the absolute identical as it was on the last pass. Plus, you once in a while will have things that to throw you a curveball. Like we were on the second side on Thelma's album, and it was a perfect take, as perfect as it was going to be. I was even happy with my mix. Every song, we got to the last song on the side, which was "Got to Get You Into My Life," the Beatles song, and got through the first chorus. Everything's feeling great. I'm dancing. I'm just thrilled. Started the second verse, no Thelma. And I grabbed the fader, vocal fader, and shoved it. And all I heard was, I'm sorry. And of course, what could I do as the producer but hit the talk back and say, that's okay, sweetie. You sound incredible. We'll get it this time.
We're talking with Bill Schnee. His book is Chairman at the Board, Recording the Soundtrack of a Generation. You did such great work over a number of albums with Boz Scaggs. And we had Steve Lukather on a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about the break that Boz gave him and all of those guys. It was really the beginnings of Toto with Jeff Porcaro and Luke and David Paich. And we learned in the book that you brought Boz, one of my favorite recordings of his, a great song, Miss Sun. And I love the description that Porcaro had about elope in that song.
Yeah, for sure. That's it's a great story because, you know, Jeff and I were really good friends. And he popped into the studio one day where I was mixing, and he threw me a cassette, literally opened the door, threw me a cassette and said, dig it. And I put it in, and what I heard were some grooves. Just he and David Paich had gone in and just done some grooves, but they were great. And that was the beginnings of Toto. Well, they put the band together and did some more demos. And one of them that I loved was Miss Sun. And I'm convinced that's one of the songs that got them their record deal at CBS. So when the record came out, I went to Paich and I said, where's Miss Sun? And he said, yeah, we didn't use it. I said, why not? He said, you know, because, you know, we want to go in a more rock direction. And I said, wow, and that surprised me. So what I did, the first album I did with Boz, I called David and I said, hey, David, what about Miss Sun? Can I have that for Boz? He would love it, I know. And he said, no, we're going to hold on to it. You never know. You know, we might need it. Okay. And then after the album came out and CBS wanted to do a greatest hits package, they said, see if you can find something for a single to promote the hits package. And so I called David again, and I said, David, listen, this is perfect for Boz, and it's perfect for you, and I'll tell you why. You know your role in Silk Degrees. David had actually written and co-arranged, written most of the songs on Silk DeGrees, right. Foz's breakout album. And when they went to do the second album, the producer wouldn't let David co-produce it. Page said he deserved it, and I think he probably did. Definitely did, and so Dave Page didn't work with him anymore. So here I am now, a couple of albums down the road of Foz, and I said, "Look, this is going to show everybody, you know, why Silk DeGrees was Silk DeGrees. This is your song." And so he let me have it, and I actually took their demo and worked it over. And then asked Jeff, you know, the drums on this demo are great. Is there any sense doing them? And he said, well, we don't lose them, so let's try it. And if we improve it, we improve it. And I don't know that we really improved it, just maybe a little bit. He thought it was better, so I went with him. But, yeah, that's one of my favorite tracks, too.
You worked on one of the great albums of the rock era, Steely Dan's Asia. I was surprised to learn that Donald Fagen, and maybe I shouldn't be surprised, not really a fan of his own voice.
Yeah, surprised me. You know, first we started on the first song that he put a rough vocal on. He came in the control room, and I had it at what I thought was a nominal level, and he goes, "Turn my voice down." And I went, okay. I turned it down, and afterwards I said, "You don't like your voice, do you?" He said, "I hate it." Which is kind of unusual because, you know, lots of artists, that's all they listen to.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
We had Jennifer Warnes on the show a couple of years ago, and we talked about her work. And, well, she was, for a while, if you wanted an Oscar nomination for a song, you put Jennifer Warnes' voice on there. And you put together Up Where We Belong. And when I say put together, you really had to do some major assembly to match up Joe Cocker's work, and then he ends up winning a Grammy for it.
Yeah, it was kind of funny because the song had been mixed already, and Taylor Hackford, the director of the movie, didn't like the mix. So they got a hold of me and asked me to mix it for them for the single, and it came in without a track sheet. A track sheet, for those that don't know, is, you know, what comes with a tape that tells you what's on track 1, 2, 3, 4, and, you know, the 24 tracks, if that's what it is, with a kick, you know, snare, piano, all that stuff. And so there wasn't one, so I had to go through and make one, which is not that hard, just listening over and over what they are. And then the other thing, though, is that there's a thing called a comp sheet, which is what there's more than one vocal performance, where you make the switches to get the performance. And so I had to go through and write all the lyrics out and do what I thought was the best one and of each singer. And it's funny enough, you know, Jennifer's were, I think there were two tracks and they were both quite good. Joe was like, I don't know, three or four tracks, and he was not very good. He would stop in the middle of a take and say, "Stu, what's the line right there?" And he was just not all together. He was, you know, learning the song. But I put it together and came out pretty good and got the Grammy and whatnot, which point I said, wait a minute, don't I deserve the Grammy? Just kidding.
Also seems like you found a kindred spirit in the studio with the great Mark Knopfler.
Yeah, Mark is just, I've been so fortunate to work with so many really great artists. And he is a true artist in every sense of the word. And one of the guys, you know, like David Gates is another one from Bread, the guy that wrote and sang all the Bread hits. You know, if you meet these guys on the street and we're introduced to them, you'd never guess that they sang in front of hundreds of thousands of people, you know, and sold millions of records. Just as nice and normal as you'd ever want to see.
And our friend Ken...
Mark's tremendous, and then there's his guitar playing,
yeah,
which, you know, he's on everybody's best whatever list of guitarists in the world.
Our friend Ken Franklin reminded me, too, that you also mixed the last album from Frankie and the Knockouts. Frankie Previtt's a great friend of the show, and the Jeff Porcaro played on that album.
Yeah, that was, I produced it, actually. Yeah, Frankie was great. I loved Frankie and loved working with him. It was a real pleasure.
Well, the The book is tremendous. I read it in a night, couldn't put it down. I want to go back and read it again to dig deeper into some of the wonderful stories of what really is an amazing career. I looked at that. The pictures of your studio, too, are absolutely beautiful. The book is Chairman at the Board, Recording the Soundtrack of a Generation. Bill Schnee, it's been a real treat. Thank you so much for visiting with us today.
Oh, great. Thank you for having me. By the way, did you get into the online stuff?
I did, yeah.
The deleted scenes, yeah.
Oh, it was terrific.
That's kind of fun.
You love it all. The book is great. Get your hands on it. You'll enjoy it. And if you love music, you're going to really enjoy the stories that Bill has to tell in this book. Bill, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
That is Bill Schnee on Downtown.